You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
This episode of the Sinister Podcast is brought to you by LT Wright Knives. LT Wright Knives are handcrafted in Ohio with the finest locally sourced materials. They build everything from everyday carry to bushcraft and even overland specific. Everything that LTWK builds comes with a lifetime guarantee and is designed from the ground up to be a solid working knife. Find out more online at centersteer.com/LTWK. The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners. Welcome to the Center Steer Podcast. This is show number 35, February 2016. This is the only Land Rover podcast that we're aware of. We're part of the 4x4 Radio Network, and I invite you to check out the other 4x4 related shows at 4x4radionetwork.com. Also, visit our website, centersteer.com, that's C-E-N-T-R-E in the British spelling, to listen to previous shows and for show notes, which have links to stories discussed in today's show. I want to thank you for your comments, your follows, your likes on Facebook and Twitter. I'm your host, John Costage, and joining me from Western Pennsylvania in a wonderfully, excessively warm day here in Western Pennsylvania. It's 60-some degrees Fahrenheit. Sitting across from me is...
I'm Harold.
And all the way from the wonderful Green Mountain State...
Hi, I'm Morgan.
He's via Skype, so he's not actually in Western Pennsylvania. What's the weather like in...
Moderately warm today. I think it's in the low 40s.
Do you have a window to the outside world?
I do, thankfully.
They allow you to have windows in Vermont?
Occasionally.
Our guest this month is Michael Bishop. He's the author of They Found Our Engineer, Othard Goddard, Land Rover's First Engineer. He'll be coming up on the show later, and he's also a senior instructor at the Land Rover Experience in Sully Hall. So he should have a lot of good info for us today. I think that's kind of excited by that, to have him join us on the show. First up, let's talk about the news. And in January, Land Rover sales, JLR in particular, were the most highest percentage of any company in the United States. That's up 7.03%. beating Fiat Chrysler at 6.94%. Of course, the number of vehicles, we won't go into that. It's 7,000 vehicles versus 155,000 vehicles for Fiat Chrysler. Specifically, Land Rover was up, and where did my number go here? Land Rover itself was up 7%, and Jag was up 6.79%. Good for Jag. That's why I wanted to bring it up, because I know we had talked Jag was down the last couple months.
They had nowhere to go but up, it seems.
They sold an extra, 100 cars, I think. Oh, no. Yeah. Jag in 2015 sold 1,266 vehicles. And Jag in January 16 sold 1,352. What's that? It's about about 90 vehicles more.
And more is more.
Land Rover sold 5,281 in January 15, and in January 16 sold 5,655. So they're up about 400. So good news. Sales are going up. And along those lines, the Range Rover Evoque, I think, is the best-selling Land Rover of all time. They have just hit their 500,000th car produced at Sully Hall within 4 years. They had the 500,000 vehicle production mark just over 4 years since it went on sale. One in every three Land Rovers sold around the world is an Evoque. And production at the Halewood plant is in operation 24 hours a day. New vehicle coming off the line every 80 seconds.
Well, it makes sense to a certain extent when you consider its spiritual predecessor, the Freelander, was the top-selling vehicle in Europe for quite a while.
Huzzah.
For what that's worth.
And if anything, it brings money in, does it not? So to help with development of future vehicles and keeping the vehicles that we like and the heritage production parts continuing, too.
Well, it expands the customer base. It's a good gateway drug.
That, too. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. It is a gateway drug, is it not? There are now 500,000 Evoques on the road. Continuing in the United States, information, J.D. Power and Associates had their vehicle dependability study come out for 2016, and this is problems per 100 vehicles, and a Land Rover was not at the bottom. The most was Dodge at 208, then Ford, 204, Smart Cars at 199, and Land Rover, 198. The only one that beat them, not the only one, everybody else beat them, but interestingly, Jeep was at 181, so just they're about the same in dependability. For reference.
So that's a good slogan then. We're not last.
We're not last. The industry average is 152, and as I said, Land Rover's at 198, and the best is Lexus at 95 problems per 100 vehicle. Lexus, Porsche, Buick, Toyota, GMC, all in that top five slot.
Yeah, and someone in Japan has lost their head over those 95 problems.
They've usually been at the top for forever.
Yeah, right, but one problem is one problem too many, so 95 is a shame to them.
Right. Yeah, the Toyota production system, they actually stop the line whenever there's a problem. They'll actually, you know, re-engineer a problem right there on the line to make sure it doesn't come back in any future vehicles.
And then the supervisor will apologize for allowing it to happen.
Isn't that the Kaizen method? You should check out This American Life did a podcast about the new me plan and talks all about that and how that freaked out the Americans when they brought that concept to the U.S. Like, what? Stop the line? We never stop the line.
Yeah. Back in the 80s, there was a comedy called Gung Ho. I think it was a Ron Howard project. It was Michael Keaton.
And Michael Keaton, Pittsburgher.
Who's actually from this area, and it was set in this area, which is kind of cool. So it's fun to watch for that reason. And it's really meant to be a comedy, but actually, yeah, it's a lot like in the film.
Well, I think that was a takeoff on that Numi plant business. And when they came in, I think that was what that was referencing. Because it was a whole new concept of get it right the first time. If there's a problem, stop the line. We'll fix it then, because they want to put out a quality product.
And the Americans don't work that way. And so they had a lot of culture to learn.
Exactly. And yeah. And then robots came in. Moving along, last month we mentioned that the Silverstone facility was for sale, and there was some discussion that maybe JLR would build that and move their headquarters there. Well, that updated information is that may happen, but it's maybe down the road. There's nothing concrete. They're still in some generic discussion, so I'm not sure if there's anything going to happen with that or not.
That'd be cool.
Yeah. New vehicle information. Looks like the Disco 5 is continuing in its development. And the headline here from Car Scoops is new lighter Land Rover Discovery spotted playing out in the snow. So prepare yourselves. There's a new.
I like the spy photos. The camouflage it's wearing is spectacular. I actually love. You know, I usually like the spy shot camo stuff that the manufacturers use. But yeah, I'd like to get a wrap done like that.
This is far more artistic than most are.
Yes, this one's really. I don't want to move the computer too much.
No, I've seen it. It's fine.
Yeah, so it's out there. I think. Did they say where? I got to scan this again. It didn't say. The British SUV is expected to offer seating for seven, like its predecessor, in a modern, comfortable environment with higher quality materials and the latest safety and off-road electronic systems.
In a modern, comfortable environment, because the Disco 4 was primitive and uncomfortable.
It was, of course. Fuel efficiency will also be dramatically improved thanks to the new aluminum platform.
How could it not? Already
underpinning the Range E's and the Ingenium family of petrol and diesel engines, which will include a hybrid powertrain. So, new Disco 5 coming. And I like this article. This was in the New York Times, and I know you need a... I was able to see the video, even though I think you need to subscribe to them. But I was able to see the video, so you may or may not be able to get to it. But I do have a link to the – it'll be in the show notes. Restoring Diesel's good name with a new Range Rover. So the New York Times here in the U.S. did a review of the new Rangey with the diesel, the TD6 3-liter turbo diesel, and they loved it. Of course, you're going to pay $104,000 for it. The interesting thing about this was saying that, you know, Land Rover was going down this path of bringing diesels to the U.S. They probably did it at the wrong time, unbeknownst to them, thanks to Volkswagen. But this may redeem diesels in the United States because it's well done. It's quiet. It's quieter on the inside, not surprisingly, than even the outside, which is, they say, it's tough to hear. And the mileage is outstanding. Fuel economy is officially rated by the government at 22 miles per gallon in the city, 29 on the highway, and they averaged 28 in mixed driving, heavy on urban slogging. So that's That's a great number.
Well, yeah, and the nice thing about the EPA ratings on a diesel is it's hard not to beat the APA number. So you look at the sticker on the window, and your chances are you're going to do at least as well as that number.
Especially for diesels, yeah. not for
with diesel, not with gasoline, and absolutely not with a hybrid.
Yeah, right. So check out that article if you want to see what they have to say. There's a nice video to watch, and you can see the nice things they have to say about it and the premium quality. And you get to see the needles moving on the dash, which is all electronic display. And
it's cool that they actually still have needles.
No, they don't. They're electronic needles.
But at least they look like needles.
They
still
do. Well, the sub ticks on the they light up as you move, so it goes up. It's pretty slick. Yeah. Hey, that's some neat visual display stuff. Did see a note here that the diesel engine is a $1,500 add-on extra.
That's not bad, actually. Some companies charge more than that.
That's right.
Yeah, and they definitely consider it well worth that investment. So that's good to hear them summarize.
Absolutely it is. But it's nice to have them admit it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So moving into some historical news, there is a silent video, original pre-production Land Rover testing at Angsley. It's about 2 minutes and 12 seconds. I'll have a link again in the show notes. It's on YouTube. There's no audio at all. It just shows the Series 1s bouncing around the sand dunes. I have no other context for you but that.
Probably just up the hill from where it was originally sketched.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
Because Red Wharf Bay is in Anglesey.
It's in Anglesey. That's in Wales, right?
Yes.
Very cool. Very cool.
And I believe some of this footage has been shown before in, like, mixed in with Land Rover's, you know, ads for Heritage ads and End of the Defender and stuff like that.
It all looked new to me. I don't recall seeing some of this, but it's very possible. Maybe I just didn't notice it, but it looked all new to me.
Yeah, it's very short clips that I've seen
mixed
in, but yeah.
You remember Graham Aldous did the those couple videos, and he was our very first guest on the show. I thought I would have seen this stuff in his material, but I did not, and because it looks new to me, anyways. But it's unclear when it's from, and only 69 views so far. Maybe we'll bump up their views.
We need to fix that.
Yeah, we can do it. We can do it.
If we spend an evening clicking and clicking and clicking and clicking,
that's right. So I have a quiz for you, gentlemen. Rust Bucket Land Rover on sale for staggering £200,000. Do you know why?
Well, you already told us why.
I know, but
so it's kind of a spoiler.
I know, but come on, do you happen to know why? You didn't. I know Harold wasn't sure, but I think.
Yeah, I had actually seen this earlier and forgotten, but it's it was the first diesel Series 1 that they produced.
That's correct. It is
the first Land Rover with a diesel engine.
Yes.
Yes.
All Land Rovers were all petrol until 57, and they started building diesel models. The quote here is, I understand that there was 5 prototypes built in 56, and this vehicle was the first ever production of the diesel 88-inch.
It looks like it was, you know, they kept it themselves for a while and sold it to someone in 1974.
It looks like it went through a fire, doesn't it?
yeah, it's in really rough shape. It says it was used until 1982.
I think rough. You're being charitable,
but it's still fixable.
It is
other things from 1957 that you find in that kind of condition is worth saving.
And let's face it, if this had actually gone through a fire, there would be no Burma Bright panels left on it. All the Burma Bright looks actually pretty straight.
Yeah, you're right. Good point.
It wouldn't have been much of a fire if it had been through a fire.
Yeah.
So moving on in additional historical Land Rover news, this I didn't know, and I saw this article. It is from September of 14, but someone had forwarded on to me, and I thought it was still interesting to bring up because we have not talked about it before. So you've heard of the Santana, which were those knockdown kits that were built in Spain up until, as I've learned here, till like 1983 when they severed their relationship with Land Rover, or Land Rover severed the relationship with Santana, and that's not clear to me. But apparently Santana then sold some of that material, the production line, sold it to Iran, to a company there called, and I apologize if I say this wrong, Moratab or Moratab. And they produce the Pazan, the P-A-Z-H-A-N. And so that is an Iranian-built Land Rover, effectively, from the guts of Santana.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
What I always thought was interesting about Santana wasn't just that they were doing the knockdown kits, but they were doing some re-engineering, and they're responsible for some. They kind of went their own way mechanically a little bit, and they're responsible for some of the cool bits that we take for granted now in a series, like the parabolic spring, for instance, came out of Santana.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, because the article mentions that when they did sever the relationship was when Land Rover went to coil sprung Defender, the 110 and the 90, and they continued to make the Leaf Sprung. So that makes a lot of sense.
And then they became in cahoots with the Iveco, and it got rebranded as the Iveco Massif.
Oh, okay.
So if you hear that name, that's the heritage.
And, you know, there are were available a lot of the Santana upgrades. They had much better, you know, brake booster systems and stuff like that that you could just drop into series Land Rovers.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
In fact, they advertised their vehicles as not the soft Land Rovers.
Didn't they do the power brakes before Land Rover did?
They might have.
I can't remember.
I don't remember.
I can't remember exactly on that. But I think they did the LT85, didn't they?
I think so.
So the last time we had to record the podcast, it was a few days after Defender production had completely shut down, and a couple articles had come out. But since then, there were a number of articles that came out, and we'll have links to those in the show notes. But a couple that I found interesting was that the Isle of Man had a tribute, and they brought out as many Land Rovers and Defenders as that they could find, and actually spelled out Defender that you could see from the air. Land Rover itself on their website, and again, it'll be linked to the show notes. You can get a Defender tour. There's a video, and there's also pictures that you can step through and go through the production line. And I, a little feather in my cap, this reminds me exactly like the tour that I got to take when I was at the. I took the visit to Sully Hall a year and a half ago. Yeah,
equally look, but don't touch.
Yes.
Nice to have been their guinea pig, though.
Yeah, that was pretty. I have to say, that was pretty cool. Expedition Portal has a nice article called The Last Land Rover Defender, and they talk about what happened on that day and some history, things you probably already know, but the one thing I did learn from this was that the project name for the new Defender replacement is called Project 663.
They're three short on that.
Either that or they've extended the wheelbase a lot.
That's pretty good.
That'd be fun to park.
They've extended the wheelbase a lot. Then Autoblog has a nice article. They kind of did a roundup of new Defender information, and it's entitled Land Rover Ponders Where to Build New Defender. Some things we already know, but a couple little interesting things. You know, there's the production had ended. There's still discussion as to whether it should be built in Slovakia or should we continue heritage and continue to build in the UK. Things we already know this, but just to remind everybody, you know, Jerry McGovern says that, quote, now knows what the new Defender will look like, but the person who said that said they didn't know offer any other further details about it. Reading between the lines in this article, it wasn't clear to me, but it almost seemed like they might push out the debut a year or two. It was originally supposed to come out for the 70th anniversary in 18, but it almost seems like that might get pushed out. I don't know.
Well, you know, if they wait an extra year, keep us waiting that much longer, by the time it does get here, we'll be so desperate for anything that we'll put up with it being stupid.
So interesting to think about. They kind of summarize a lot of things we had talked about, that the volume they want to increase from the 20,000 annually to 100,000 or more.
They have to.
And yeah, and they're going to try to make it more civilized, move it up market. So there you go.
And, you know, it's no small task to set up a whole production line.
No.
For a new vehicle that they're still designing, you know.
Yeah, but, well, you get just put a bunch of robots in place, and I mean, there's not many. There, it's no longer going to be. You know, what are humans going to do with this new one? They're not going to touch it. Probably the first time they touch it, it's going to be the steering wheel when they open it, or the door when they open it up to drive it off the line.
Still, even most of those robots are designed specifically for their one task in the production line. Even though they may be somewhat generic, they're all programmed to do the exact same thing every time. and nail it. So
you had one job, Mr. Robot.
Well, and that robot needs custom hands, if you will. The tooling that actually deals with the part is very, very custom to the job. So then there's cost involved in setting all that up.
Yeah, and you know, when you're still trying to pick the location you're going to do that.
Did you have a thought?
I don't know where.
Did you have a thought, Morgan?
I wasn't sure if that was the audio dropping out or your brain dropping out.
I think I'm gonna leave that pause in just for fun.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I was gonna say that, you know, there's a lot of cost involved, in, you know, not just in the tooling and setting up the production, but there's cost involved in developing the product and the engineering time and everything else. And when you're not expecting to have a 67-year product life cycle, you've got to sell a lot of them to pay for it.
I mean, if it's going to be based off, most likely, is it the frame going to be similar to a frame they already have? I mean, don't they have a lot of this already ready to go?
Yeah, the sad thing is I suspect it's going to be a 100-inch platform like everything else. And it's not going to come in 90s and 110s and 130s like a Defender should.
I believe actually Jerry has said it's going to come in multiple
right.
things.
Well, so it may, if it does, then Jerry's done one thing right.
They may, but I think your point is taken, though, that they may start off with, you know, 100 inch, and then you may
the concept,
see
the DC 100. That's where the 100 comes from. It was based on what they already made.
Right, right. So we continue our Defender watch here at the podcast's headquarters. We will continue to watch that, of course, and bring you the news as we know it. I don't know. Did that sound good?
As patiently as we can.
Are we patient?
No, not at all.
Okay.
But, you know, we try.
Not a word I'd use to describe really any of us.
Well, actually,
certainly not our host.
Actually, if you think about it, though, if you drive a series truck, you do have to be patient. So there is some inherent patience in if you own a series truck.
Well, yeah, not by choice.
Yes, it's by design. And back to Jerry.
Jerry needs to spend some seat time in a series truck. Maybe he'd get it then.
He probably wouldn't appreciate it. He'd hate it even more.
But see, you'd have to make him drive that until he got it.
That's true. It's worth a shot.
And, you know, if that meant we had to wait an extra 2 years for the new Defender, that might be time well spent.
I give you that. Now that I agree with you on.
Can we drop him in a very remote area with a series Land Rover so that, you know, he really is forced to use it enjoying the fact that he had it?
Let's give him a leaky old one, 6 spanners and a bucket of bolts.
And Bear Grylls.
Okay, that's fine.
Two of them. He needs help. And then,
clearly he needs help, but that's another topic entirely.
So to hold you over while we wait for the new Defender, go check out Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. That's Jerry Seinfeld's online show. And he actually is a Defender fan. He has a D90, and it makes an appearance in the Jimmy Fallon episode. That's season 5, episode 8, if you want to check it out. He actually says some nice things, and he has a blue, it's like a powderish blue D90, towing a boat. So go check that out.
It's doing something important.
That's the news for the 35th edition of the Center Steer podcast. We'll be back after the M word.
One of the most difficult things about meeting new people is knowing that I will have to answer the most annoyingly ambiguous question ever created. What do you do? The smartass in me just wants to look them square in the face and say, I process food and water. I convert oxygen to carbon dioxide. And I respond to dumb questions from people like you. But I don't think they'd get it, so I'd be wasting my time. They probably meant to ask me what I do to earn a living, but that's not really the answer they're looking for either. Usually, they just want me to reduce my professional life down to a one-word label, like salesman, lawyer, or accountant. I refuse to do that. I hate labels. Labels may help to define something, but they can also be very confining. Just like potato chips, I cannot limit myself to just one. I'm a homeowner, a consumer, a citizen, and a taxpayer. I'm also a landlord, as I own the building where my shop is located, and that comes with many responsibilities. I'm a business owner, a consultant, a curator, a historian, and a project manager. The list goes on. According to my corporate mission statement, I'm dedicated to preserving the rich heritage of British motoring. But when I try to describe what that means, people cut me off with the most ignorant response. So you're a mechanic then? Perhaps it's because people don't really care. Or maybe they just can't imagine a world where people don't define each other with one-word labels. Using the M word is insulting to a professional technician. It's much like referring to an award-winning chef like Gordon Ramsay as a fry cook. Professional technicians have a solid foundation in math and science and a firm grasp of how and why things work the way they do. We work hard to learn our craft, and we continue learning in order to keep up with advances in technology. A mechanic is a trained monkey, not a trained professional. He or she gets paid to turn wrenches, but lacks the education and experience necessary to perform accurate diagnosis and component-level repairs. A mechanic simply swaps parts based on hunches or the advice of others. Mind you, in the right circumstances, this can be a valuable service. Likewise, there is a need for people who dig ditches, but let's not confuse them with landscape architects. One label I do like is that of fabricator. I really enjoy taking a piece of raw metal and making something special. Sometimes this means I'm also an engineer, and on really good days, a sculptor and an artist. I also enjoy taking something ordinary and modifying it to make something unique, but please don't call me a customizer. That word has been ruined by legions of self-proclaimed experts who think that all it takes to make something really custom is a fancy paint job and a bunch of bolt-on accessories ordered out of a catalog. Serious fabricators call these people cake decorators. I would now like to offer my sincere apology to the many talented people who earn a good living by decorating cakes. Since custom fabrication often allows me to give new life to things that others would dismiss as scrap or even junk, I'm also a preservationist and an environmentalist, since reducing any and all forms of waste is good for the planet. Speaking of environmentalism, there's a common belief that old cars and trucks are bad for the environment. This could not be farther from the truth. Professionals in the green building industry often say that there is no greener material than the one that's already installed. The same can be said about vehicles. Maybe it's different for commercial vehicles that travel hundreds of thousands of miles every year, but for most people, the greenest vehicle they will ever own is the one that's already in their driveway. What people need to understand is that environmental impact is so much more than just tailpipe emissions. It takes a tremendous amount of resources and energy to manufacture a new vehicle, especially when you consider that raw materials from one part of the planet are often shipped several times to be refined, manufactured, assembled, and finally shipped to the consumer. A properly maintained older vehicle can be driven for years or even decades before it will have the same environmental impact as just buying a new one. Now, if you're one of those people who likes to buy a new car every couple of years, go right ahead. Don't let me stop you. Just don't try to tell me it's better for the environment. Newer isn't necessarily better. It's just newer. On the other hand, if you like old cars and trucks, by all means, you should keep them. Make sure they're properly maintained. And if they break, fix them. And most importantly, you should enjoy driving them as much as you want without feeling guilty. You're actually doing your part for the environment. Recently, I came up with a new label to describe some of the skills I use in my job. I am an automotive oncologist. Like cancer, rust and corrosion are malignant growths which attack the health and shorten the lifespan of any vehicle. As with humans and their genetic tendencies, certain vehicles are more prone to rust than others, but all can benefit from preventive medicine and a healthy lifestyle. Just like cancer, rust isn't terminal if detected early enough, and treatment methods include surgical excision, chemotherapy, and reconstructive surgery. After 35 years of repairing rust damage, I've decided this specialty needs to be recognized. I'm sure if I keep thinking about it, I could come up with many more labels to describe what I do. But as I said before, I really don't like labels. Instead, I figured out a better way to answer the annoying question. From now on, when they ask, I will just smile and say, I make the world a better place, one ride at a time.
The Center Steer Podcast is proud to have our first sponsor, LTW Knives. LTW Knives are handcrafted in Ohio with the finest locally sourced materials. They build everything from everyday carry to bushcraft and even overland specific. Everything that LTWK builds comes with a lifetime guarantee and is designed from the ground up to be a solid working knife. Each piece is constructed with survival in mind. Knives with a proven international pedigree that have been there and back. Bushcraft, hunting, camping, overland, and everyday carry models are available. Our new Bushcrafter HC is an excellent example of an everyman knife, able to do everything from help get the campfire started to skinning game. Being made from 3/32 1075 steel and with a convex edge, it will resharpen easily in the field. These heirloom quality pieces will outlast your adventure, so plan well, drive safely, and carry an LTWK. Find out more online at ltwrightknives.com or centersteer.com/LTWK. Welcome back to the Center Steer Podcast. This is show number 35 for February 2016, and I'm now excited to introduce our guest, Michael Bishop. He is the author of They Found Our Engineer, Arthur Goddard, Land Rover's First Engineer. If you don't have a copy of the book, go out and get one and read it. It's available through Amazon. I think that's where I got it. Is that right, Mike? Can you get it through Amazon?
Yeah, that's probably the best place to find it.
Good deal, good deal. And he's also the senior instructor for the Land Rover Experience at Sully Hall, and he was the Celebration Line project leader. We're looking forward to discussing all of these topics today, but first, I want to introduce Mike. Welcome to – you like Mike or Michael?
Michael. Yeah, either.
Good.
Matter.
Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us. We are excited.
And some of us are excited that you are actually the first guest we've ever had on our show who had to get permission from Land Rover to be here.
That is cool.
Yeah, I mean, I was fairly close to the action last year with the Celebration Tour and being the project leader on that. So, I was a voice of Land Rover, which I still am, obviously. So,
Graham Alda says you're becoming the new Mr. Land Rover.
Yeah, usually I say to people I'm the apprentice, you know, and even Roger himself used that term recently. So if Roger says it, it must be true.
That's quite an honor.
Well, I didn't try to achieve it. It's one of those things that, you know, if the opportunity comes your way, you
grab it.
Grab it and run. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Indeed. So you wrote the book. How did that come about? How did that start? I mean, I've read the book, but we want to hear it from you.
Okay, so basically there's two sides to the book. There's all the research that was done by the majority of the people here in the UK. And, you know, a few of us around the world into, you know, the two stories of the original Land Rover. Because if you look at it, you know, from the information that is supplied by the original company, there's two facets to it. The first one is the stopgap story, which is, you know, it's the PR story of the day, explaining to the customers why it's come about, how it's going to fit in with the old original luxury Rover cars and all of that. And then there's the other story of course, all these beautiful old engineering photographs. And the two stories clash, they do, because if you had a stopgap vehicle, why on earth would you go and develop it? And that fascinated a lot of us, you know, for years as to why on earth would you, you know, try and achieve that? And, you know, how on earth did they go about doing that? And so we researched for years and years and years, and part of that research involved finding all the development vehicles in the records. And of course, you pull out all these development records, you know, and chassis numbers of vehicles, and you find that most of them went to Arthur Goddard. And that's how, you know, that name came to be known by a few of us who thought, who is he? What did he do? Because you never really heard his name mentioned. And I suppose after, you know, doing that for such a long time, is one of those things that's sort of in your back of your mind. Suddenly somebody mentions it, you're like, wait a tick, you know, say that again. And that's basically how it all happened. Arthur appeared as a throwaway conversation on Skype, funnily enough, when I was very early days at living over here, and a friend from Australia rang me, and Alex, and he said that he's opposite his father's business, there was this old man who had a off-road trailer manufacturing business, and he'd worked at Land Rover back in the day, and his name was Arthur Goddard. And it was one of those things, I can remember it as clear as yesterday. I had to sort of do a double take because I wasn't really concentrating on the phone call at the point. Because we've been talking about all kinds of facets of Land Rover, and Alex was pretty young at the time. He was probably about 19, and as often as not, teenagers are, they get incredibly overexcited. Suddenly that I said, say that again, Alex. And he said, oh yeah, it's Arthur Goddard. And I said, prove it. And he pulled up the guy's website and just pulled it over, and I just it was the weirdest feeling. It must be the kind of feeling that people have when they get a lottery ticket or something like that, and they think they've won. They've won the lottery. They've won millions of dollars or whatever, because they just couldn't believe it was happening.
So you were in the UK at the time when this happened?
Yeah, at that point, yeah. I suppose I've been researching with a few friends of mine. I don't know if you read Land Rover owner, there's Peter Galilee, mm-hmm. and who have been I've known for years and years, who I've been researching with, and James Taylor was always there in the background. In the early club, the register Land Rover register 1948 to 1953. And Ken Wheelwright and all these guys were quite well, really, really known. Phil Bashel, really, really well known restorers. And I suppose because I was quite good at writing and storytelling, I was always in the magazine saying, have you noticed this? You found that? Oh, look at this. This has turned up. And we studied the vehicles. And once I was at that point in my early 20s, late teens, early 20s myself, and started traveling to the UK, and I'm lucky enough to have dual nationality from my mother's side, and just kept on coming back and forwards and backwards and forwards to Australia and finding more and more and more parts and vehicles and elements, and you could come over and you could sort of start to study those early development vehicles like Huey and some of the other famous vehicles from that stage, and try to piece this story together. Why on earth would you say you had a stopgap vehicle when you put all this development money into it? And that was effectively the question. And Arthur was able to answer that question fairly clearly and fairly directly when we got hold of him. Yes, there was an element where it was pulled together really, really quickly. But, they've got to – when you're in the automotive business, and you'll see this right across, the whole industry, getting the message right for the customers – absolutely critical, and it's just simply because there's just so much money involved. And once the original Land Rover, it cost £95,000 in 1947 to put it into production, which is sort of the equivalent of £300 to £400 million in today's money. And it cost that was an enormous amount of money, and they don't generally take massive risks on things like that. So you've got to get your message right.
So. That was a stopgap. That was the what was that? That was the part of the center steer version, right?
Yeah, I mean, what we found out. I mean, the research basically it's moved on even since I they found our engineer. We found out we discovered so much more about that stage, and we put a lot of that into the celebration tour. Into an area called the engineer's pod, which you can see all this online. If you go to, I'll give you a website a little bit later on for virtual tour.
Defender tour?
Virtual tour.
Yeah, I think we found that already. We have a link to that in our show notes.
Oh, brilliant! Yeah, so if you go in there's an engineer's pod, and the engineer's pod's a deep dive area to go into all this. If anybody asked the question, because you were standing there beside the cutaway vehicle. And showing how they came up with the ideas, and what they in today's world they call the packaging of the vehicle, which is essentially where the customer sits and how they operate it. And Maurice Wilkes was very, very into this kind of thing. He was as a leading engineer and a person who was so into developing ideas with his different facets he had, because he had his jet cars and he had Land Rovers and he had all kinds of interesting engineering ideas. And so that's basically what happened. Is they had their idea. The idea came about from moving the company to Solihull. Solihull was double the size of the original Helen Street Rover factory in Coventry, which had been unfortunately bombed flat during the Second World War. And so you've got a factory double the size, you've got the opportunity to produce double the vehicles. And that's when you sort of think, okay, how are we going to actually do this? You know, and they originally called the idea the alternative product. It wasn't called the stopgap. It was called, you know, the alternative. That was getting from 10,000 units to 20,000 units. And that's ultimately what the Land Rover achieved from a business point of view. But, yeah, going back to explaining all that to customers of the time, you know, in post-war Britain and throughout the world, especially in markets where they'd never seen Rover cars before, because before the Second World War, Rover had never made a left-hand drive vehicle. That only exported to the British Empire. So getting all that out was, you know, critical, and getting it all to match in with the, you know, the politics of post-war Britain with the export drive and all that was a complicated story. And if you sort of think of the way it was described as a stopgap and then apply all those little facets in, you sort of think, okay, I can understand why they stopped calling it alternative product and started calling it a stopgap.
The Wilkes brothers sketched on the beach. Is that, that's a true story?
That's definitely a true story. And I've got they... that. I've got a copy of an unpublished book by a chap called Bernard Light, who was the company historian back in the 1950s. And he has a section where he's describing that story. Obviously, he's had one of the Wilkes brothers, either Spencer or Morris, just, you know, tell him what happened on that day. And they said they because obviously Morris's holiday home was on Anglesey, and Spencer's holiday home is on the island of Islay, just up the coast, up in Scotland. And he had quite a big yacht, and he sailed his yacht down to Anglesey, and they had a meeting about this alternative product, what was going to be. And both of them had sort of gone off in different areas. Morris in the actual engineering, what could they produce? And Spencer in the business side of things, who were they going to sell it to? Who is going to be the customers? Where are they going to get the money from? Where are they going to get? Could they get any tax incentives and all that kind of thing that CEOs work with on government levels? So there's a lot more to it once you really sort of dig into this story. And in, I suppose, writing the book, it was trying to sort of give that insight that Arthur had as being, you know, sort of the man underneath the Wilkes brothers, sort of pulling the program together of the vehicle going into production and being developed. Yeah, what was he being, what was he receiving from his boss? What was he being told? What direction was he going in? And that was the fascinating thing about that story. And it's not wanting to take anything away from myths. One thing that is great in the Land Rover storyline is all the myths and the bits and pieces that go with that. And I don't think I've realised from the celebration tour, you can't really, the myths are so strong, and obviously that stopgap story, it is a little bit of a myth, you know, in one sense, but it's just a PR story. But you, as that keeps on going along and people sit and talk around campfires or talk in their garage while they're restoring their car or Land Rover or whatever they're doing, that snowball effect will just keep turning and turning and turning. So once again, it's a really, really clever game it is that they came up with. And, those Wilkes brothers, they were exceptionally good at that kind of thing.
So the Wilkes brothers came up with the stopgap idea? I mean, the idea.
Yeah, I think you know, looking at it closely, they controlled the whole company, the two of them. I mean, it was a very small company compared to what it is today. I mean, you think of 10,000 cars, and you know, today it's, you know, Jaguar Land Rover, it's like 500,000 cars, so it was absolutely, you know, tiny compared to what it was. So it had nowhere near the number of people working in it. So they could, you know, very easily sort of control it and say, why don't we do this and why don't we try that and really sort of drive the business themselves from that point of view. And I think, changing it from alternative product, which sounds really, really boring, and, you know, to stopgap, which sounds interesting, is very, very clever, idea.
Well, Land Rover continues, I will say. They do certainly have a good marketing streak, and it sounds like it starts at the very beginning because that sounds like a good marketing ploy. So the Wilkes brothers, they sketched in the sand, and was that effectively just handed off to Mr. Goddard then? Is that what happened?
No, what they did then is they started to piece together, and Morris at his level started to piece together, you know, how the basic elements of the engineering were going to work. And they started with the main shaft of the gearbox, of actually grafting a Jeep transfer box onto the back of a Rover car gearbox to be able to start testing it and see if it was going to work and see if their ideas would come together. That's what he started doing. But it was very, very early days. He would have done that in the tool room. We've seen the drawing of that. And Spencer went off on his business side, which was really, really, really complicated at the time, because there was a Minister of Supply, Mr. Wilmot in the UK, who was wasn't a great friend of the motor industry, and he basically came up with a policy that was basically one model or your business is going to be shut down, which obviously put the fear of God through the whole motor industry, and they grouped together, you know, all the car industry, and went and, you know, started campaigning the government that this isn't going to work, it's going to put us out of business, it's going to, you know, it's not good for jobs. Ultimately ended up with them actually being a change in minister. Wilmot didn't see out 1947. So but the pressure on that, of course, it caused a lot of the car companies to change direction quite quickly. And I suppose the most spectacular change was the Land Rover coming to life. And in September 1947, the board unanimously, the Rover board unanimously approved it to go into production. Which, if you read through, you go through these board minutes, it's generally it's pretty conservative stuff. We're going to invest in here, and we're going to do this, and the forecast is going to be so many sales and so many vehicles, and all that sort of normal sort of business stuff. And it's going to take 2 years or 3 years or how long to get the vehicle into production. Land Rover was totally different. It was like, right, approve it. Right, okay, get this. Yes, this will work. Oh, by the way, how much is this going to cost? Do we need to budget, And it really was quite rushed at the time. But, obviously Arthur and his team, once they'd been given that brief on what to do, they had 10 months to get the vehicle into production, which in the modern world, and if you consider sort of post-war, post-Second World War, probably as the modern world of vehicles, because, they had, modern style brakes, and performance was, relatively quick compared to, post-Second World War, pre-Second World War cars, which were, relatively primitive. Yeah, it's incredibly fast to put something into production.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Yeah. It's incredibly fast even now. I mean, it takes 2 or 3 years now to get something into production.
Yeah. So they did that, and I mean, the incredible thing, and when you went around Defender, is those elements which they came up with in the design of how to assemble the vehicle hadn't really changed. So I always said to people, in theory, you could have put a Series 1 down the silly old production line, because it's just chassis with axles, put the axles on, put the engine and gearbox in, put the firewall or bulkhead on, depending on what you call it. And then put the body on, and those elements are, is what they came up with in 1947, 1948.
Right. So do you think it was rushed because of this minister who said, you need a selling car quickly? Was that part of the reason for that rush?
Excuse me. There was a number of reasons, and, there was the circumstances, post-war, for the company, which was had a lot of these big engineering companies during the Second World War in the UK had done incredibly well, because they've been Rowford, but been this one little factory with about 2,500 workers, 10,000 cars in 1939, and in 1946 it was 25 factories and around about 25,000 workers. Yeah, it grew exponentially, and their balance sheet was extremely good. They were still making parts, because there was engine parts and post-war parts still to be made, and bits of me you go through, and there's all this stuff they're still making for the government. But they wanted to get back to what their core industry was, the car industry, and ultimately really get back to luxury cars. That's what their aim was. But when they realized that wasn't quite going to work, yeah, this is where this alternative product idea came about. And if you look at, you know, the videos of Morris running around with Bren gun carriers and all kinds of things, I personally think that is him looking at all the different alternatives, because one thing Morris had done is he worked in the British motor industry for a long time, but he'd also been in the States, and he'd worked for General Motors in the 1920s. So he had a really sort of broad vision of what was being made throughout the world.
I never heard
and looking
before.
At alternative products, because I think, you know, looking at the tracked vehicles, you know, he would have seen that, you know, Caterpillar tractors were selling like hotcakes post-war. He would have, you know, he obviously saw that, you know, Willys Jeeps were done exceptionally well. He's seeing that Ferguson tractors were doing exceptionally well. So that's where he obviously is looking, is what can we build and what can we sell? Simple as that.
I had never heard that one of the Wilkes brothers was in, had visited General Motors, and that's news. Interesting. I'd like to point out, by the way, Mike, that the Willys?
Yeah.
Or the Bantam. No, the Bantam. The Bantam Jeep was produced not far from Pittsburgh, just north in Butler, PA. So we have a nice connection with that also in this area.
No, that's an interesting connection, that is. And obviously not I don't think many people know that, because the Bantam came about from Austin. You know, they were producing Austin 7s, weren't they?
They were producing Austin 7s under license, and then they actually closed that company down, and that was the American Austin Motor Company that made the Austin 7s. But Bantam actually was making copies of the Austin 7, but with their own spin on it. But it had no ties to Austin at that point.
Oh, okay. Then they got the contract, though, to make
the Jeep. They got the contract to develop the Jeep vehicle. But then once they got past the prototype stage, the production contract was given to Willys.
Because they couldn't keep up with production.
Well, that was the myth the legend is that the Quartermaster Corps was in cahoots with Ford and Willys, and so they kind of planted some seeds. And
I'm not sure. I'm sure that happened.
Yeah, but Bantam had some financial weaknesses that probably would have gone that way anyway.
They produced those in Butler, PA, which is about 20 miles or 30 miles north of our present location, and then they would put them onto barges, float them down the Allegheny River, down the Ohio, which takes you to the Mississippi. Mississippi takes you down to New Orleans, and they put them on ships and LSTs and such, and ship them across the seas.
Oh, fascinating, fascinating.
Yeah. See, Pittsburgh has a nice – I told you Pittsburgh has a strong connection with Britain, even more so.
Okay.
Well, you know, Pittsburgh is named after a British prime minister.
Is it? I have to look it up. I'm fascinated at all elements of history. And,
Pitt the Elder.
You know, I'll look it up after this.
Well, I'll give you a quick – it's William Pitt the Elder, because there was a fort here called Fort Duquesne the French had built. The British were sent, and they basically the French left. They didn't. There was no fight, and they took it over, and they built a bigger fort, renamed the area Pittsboro after William Pitt the Elder, and he was the Earl of Chatham. And on Earl of Chatham, on his crest, shield, whatever they call that heraldry, he has a black and gold checkerboard pattern, and that has continued on to this day here in Pittsburgh, because that's on the Pittsburgh crest, the checkerboard pattern, Earl of Chatham, and that's how you get the team colors for the Pirates, the Steelers, and the Penguins.
Now, it's good, all those little stories and the little connections and, you know, the attention to detail people put into these things. It always makes fascinating reading. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. All right. So back to the matter at hand. you're in Australia, splitting your time in the UK, and you hear about Mr. Goddard. And how did you actually get in touch with him, and what did you learn from him?
Well, I suppose, when we were first doing the research, it was in the mid to late 1990s, and Arthur eventually turned up in 2009, just after the 60th anniversary. So, for me personally, a lot of water had gone underneath the bridge. You know, I'd grown up, got married, stopped messing around in between, you know, two countries, and got a real job. And
so it's a hobby now, right? So you've moved into hobby status.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose my landrowing has always been a serious hobby, because, you know, I'd done some things, you know, semi-professionally. A friend, here, he bought a lot of cars and, of old Series 1s in Australia and, shipped parts over to the UK and done all kinds of, different bits and pieces. But I was working in a completely different industry. I was working in, at the time, in the property maintenance industry. There was an opportunity. An Australian company had tried to see if they could, get a hold of the UK market. And my wife was over here doing, she works in, specialist medical career. So we're both over here, and it was this connection with Alex that was really, really the clue to it. And, what had happened, again, is Alex had turned up, and he was, very like what I was when I was a late teenager. I was trying, to get a collection of interesting vehicles, despite, all the, everything's up against you when you're that age. You probably haven't got your own home. You haven't got terribly much money. All these things are against you. Mm-hmm. But he was doing really, really well at it. And his dad has quite an interesting collection of old vehicles. And Alex had got himself a Land Rover. He's been mad on them for a long time. And his father Russell had the Land Rover and this car of his. It's a 1913 Edwardian era Vauxhall, which is sort of like a Rolls Royce of the time. An incredibly big, large, interesting looking car. And he had them at his workshop, which was opposite Arthur's workshop. And being neighbours, Arthur would come out to go home and saw the Land Rover and saw this this vintage car, this old Vauxhall, and of course got talking to Russell about them. And, Russell was a very, very clever idea, to try and get Alex to go and make the connection with Arthur, as he was probably about 16 at this point. But, he couldn't quite believe that there was an engineer, an old engineer opposite him in Brisbane, Australia, who had helped design the Land Rover. It just, for him at that point in his life, it was just, no, that's not true. That can't be right. And it was only, years later talking to me, 4 or 5 years later, that I was like, that must be him. It has to be him. What we did was, Alex is very much into his technology, and, I said to him, go and get yourself a little camera and make a video of Arthur and ask him a set number of questions. And I wrote out some questions. One of the questions was based around the Minerva development. If you've heard about the Minerva Land Rovers that were built in Belgium.
Yes.
Yeah, well, the development vehicles, the test vehicles, were all dispatched out to Arthur with prototype 2-litre engines. And a friend of mine's got one of these vehicles. And there's photos of the tests and everything. And of course, Arthur would never have had these questions, in years. And so I said, go and ask him about that. And, that. And we knew the basis of the, what had happened there, and who was the chap who ran, Minerva, a chap called Van Roggen, Mr. Van Roggen, and that, and a few other questions. And Alex went off and he made a video of Arthur talking, and Arthur was answered these questions as though, it was a year ago or so that he'd been working on it. His answers are very, very clear and very, very direct. We started to learn that, we needed to really, get into this mindset of, not just being an enthusiast, but, these people are engineers, they're designing this product. They're thinking in a completely different way. And one person who definitely got me around thinking that way was Roger Craythorne. Of course, I got in touch with her. I got to know Roger through a slightly different connection in Land Rover history, but all to do with, once again, with all this early prototype research. And rang him, and he was like, I know of Arthur, but I don't know terribly much about him. And, once we got this all going, Roger was very, very good to sort of give me that sort of insight into, how an engineering automotive business actually works. in how the people think and what you're trying to achieve from the brief, you know, of, you know, we need to make a product like this and it needs to work like that. And once we'd got that right, of course, you could start to get all the information that Arthur had out of him.
Was Goddard forthcoming, or did you have to kind of dance around it for a while? It seems like, because from my reading was kind of like he was almost like, well, yeah, I did some Land Rover stuff, and oh, okay, I guess someone wants to hear about it now. That was kind of like my take on it was, not that he was waiting for anybody, but he seemed like surprised, I think, that folks were interested.
Yeah, he's an incredibly strong character. You can understand why he went off. He moved on from Rover in 1957 and went on to become the technical director of Girling Brakes. And his strong personality would have been perfect in that situation to cope with all the other chief engineers. You know, and he had some fairly formidable ones to cope with. Alfieri, Porsche, all these guys were looking at buying brake parts, you know, off Girling. And because he's always looking forward and never sort of stopping to look back, and it worked out by the time he was, you know, in his mid to late 60s that he didn't really want to retire formally, as a lot of people do, that he just wanted to keep going. He'd never stopped to sort of really sort of think about, oh, you know, back in 1947, I was involved in that team that designed the Land Rover. He's always looking forward, yeah.
So does he get the iconic status of the Land Rover? Does he get that? Maybe now, maybe not then, but
he thinks I suppose he can't quite believe it. You know, that such a simple vehicle has become so famous and so iconic. And the one line he always says to people is, "We designed it for the soldier and for the farmer." And he said, but we never thought that people would take the kids to school in it. And I suppose what he's saying in when he says that statement is, of course, you know, the one thing that the Rover, once again, they did incredibly well for a small company was they developed the vehicle into, you know, the platform where you could have it as a station wagon, you could have it as a pickup, you could have it as all these different varieties. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that led them to realise, actually, there's a market where you can actually, you know, make it a little bit more luxurious, and there's a market, you know, and all these things that a lot of the other manufacturers didn't really do quite so well. And once again, that comes back to the, you know, Maurice Wilks and Spencer Wilks being incredibly, you know, incredible visionaries within the motor industry and seeing those opportunities, yeah, for a smaller company. Yeah, because once again, if you look at you know, the original Range Rover product when it came out, and they eventually got to that stage where they could achieve, you know, a vehicle of that, it was only, you know, it's like the Series 1, it was only small numbers. It was only, you know, the first year of Range Rover, or the first couple of years, was, you know, about 6,000 units. Wow. It was nothing, you know, yeah. In today's world, where, you know, yeah, where, you know, Range Rover is around about 40,000 units a year, and Range Rover Sport's about 85,000 units a year in sales, you know. Yeah, 6,000, original Series 1, you know, first year was 3,000, you know, then they eventually 49, they did another 5,000 to 8,000. So, yeah, it's, you know, compared to, you know, a lot of the other companies within that same, you know, I suppose, you know, the off-road, what you call the SUV industry now. Now, back in the day, you know, yeah, Land Rover and Rover was, you know, they punched well above their weight, and especially on the ideas front.
Right. Mm.
So, and at what point did they sort of realize it was going to take off? You know, they launched it at what, the Amsterdam Motor Show? Was that really popular?
Yeah, they'd realized they'd got onto something a little bit before that they did. And it's in there. There's various notes in the board minutes, and there's, you know, various military militaries from various countries sort of, you know, having a little bit of interest. And of course, there was the groundnut scheme, which was the famous scheme that, you know, didn't work, where, you know, the British government was going to try and get, you know, countries in Africa, part of the, you know, Commonwealth nations, to try and produce peanuts and oil and all these kind of things. They were quite interested in the Land Rover. And I think they'd realised that, you know, what they'd initially thought they might be able to sell, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 of them. They, you know, realized it was going to be a lot bigger, and they started, you know, putting in more investment into production lines and tooling and all these kind of things, and trying to get, you know, a lot more scale out of what they designed. You know, there was an interesting thing that Arthur did say very, very early on in our discussions with him. It was like, you know, this business side of it, you know, which never really was sort of discussed before or looked into. And it's because it's all, you know, it was all done so quickly. If you go through all the board minutes sort of formally, all the Land Rover stuff is, you know, sort of scattered in between, and you have to go and read the whole lot. You can't just go in there and, you know, whereas, you know, you could, you know, before it was like that, you could just go and you could read what was going on in the company. There was, you know, a little chunk for Rover cars and a little, you know, little chunk of it for, you know, human, you know, industrial relations, and a little chunk for, you know, manufacturing engineering. The Land Rover, yeah, those initial months in late 1947, it goes all over the place. You know, people saying, oh, wait a tick, we need a budget for this, or wait a tick, we need that. Or Spencer Wilkes saying, oh, I've heard in, you know, informally that the government will buy 1,000 vehicles. And Arthur had come to us with that, and he said, well, all the funding came about from the government saying unofficially they'd have 1,000 vehicles. Hmm. And eventually we found it in the board minutes. So he was right. So, which once again throws up a really, really interesting little point. Of course, when they introduced the vehicle, of course, they said, yeah, oh, it's for the farmer and for the countryman and everything. They didn't really mention the military.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas, you know, Arthur said, no, it's, you know, that we were going to, you know, the government was after, you know, a British Jeep,
right,
as they called it. The Austin Champ was an incredibly complex vehicle. And it took them years. I mean, I think they started designing it around about 1946, and eventually went in production around about 53, 54. I'm not exactly sure.
What's the Austin Champ? I'm not familiar with that.
It's a vehicle. It's a yeah, another quarter ton four wheel drive vehicle, and it has a 2.8 liter Rolls Royce engine in it. And the design of it, the four wheel drive system, is unconventional. Compared to, you know, the two-speed transfer box system that most other manufacturers use. And what they did was they had, you could go around about sort of about 70 miles an hour, 78, probably a little bit faster, 80 miles an hour, forwards and reverse. So the system, I can't quite remember, you know.
I'm not sure I want to go in reverse at 80 miles an hour.
You really shouldn't allow the customer that kind of freedom.
No, and you've seen, if you go on YouTube, there's some people on Fraser Island in Australia driving one of these things down the beach, you know, fast, you know, it's flying down the beach. And you look at it and you go, that's crazy. Yeah, but they, you know, they're trying to design something, you know, at the point which, you know, was going to do a lot more than what the good old, you know, World War II Jeep could do. That's what they were trying to do. But it was, you know, complex and difficult to do. And once they came up with the vehicle at the end, it was really, really expensive, because the Rolls-Royce engine cost around about, you know, the same as much, you know, as much as a Land Rover would cost. And then it was really, really difficult to operate, because it had this huge complexity to it. And if you look at the original Land Rover, the one thing that, you know, Maurice Wilkes put into the design was simplicity in the four-wheel drive system. If you look at, you know, a series vehicle, it's basically designed to be a one-step system. And, you know, if you want to go into four-wheel drive, you just push down the yellow lever. That's it. That's all you do. If you want to go into low range, you just pull on the red one step each way. And, of course, you know, other manufacturers, you know, you had to do maybe one in high, but you had to generally do two in low. You had to do four-wheel drive.
And lock the hubs. You had to get out of the vehicle.
And then lock, you know, lock hubs and do all this other stuff. Whereas, you know, they wanted to do that. And that's one thing that, you know, they exploited incredibly well with the demonstration team. You know, just jump in the Land Rover, just pull on the red lever and just drive up the hill. Job done.
So how much actual, say, input did Mr. Goddard have? Would he have a lot of sway in the early development? Or was he just dealing with the engineering problems that were presented to him? Or did he actually have a lot of say in, say, the design and the development and the engineering?
I suppose what the one thing he did, I mean, he was very obviously very young at the time, and you had setups of the different experts. So you had, you know, Jack Swain, who was the engineering engine expert, and then you had Frank Shaw, who was transmissions, and Gordon Bashford, who was chassis. And so they went off and they started designing, you know, from the brief that they got. But because, you know, there wasn't, you know, someone who was sort of pulling it all together, because obviously there was, you know, so much other stuff that, you know, Maurice Wilkes was doing as the, you know, as the technical director. You know, he's not, you know, there sort of, you know, keeping his finger on the pulse or, you know, micromanaging his team. He doesn't need to do that. Yeah, they're, you know, professional people. They can do, look after themselves. Arthur became the person, the man who pulled it all together, made sure that, you know, what, you know, was going on in the engine department was, you know, going to match exactly what Frank was doing in the, you know, the gearbox and transfer box department. And, you know, what was going on with, you know, the bodies and everything, all it all came together. That's something they could, you know, he could go to Maurice Wilkes and say, yeah, this is working, or actually this doesn't work so well. Can we, how do we develop that, or what should we do with this, or how should we go down this route? And that was basically Arthur's job. He was a program manager of that.
So in that, so, in that sense, he was sort of Morris's number two then?
Yeah, yeah, he was the second, okay. Yeah. He was the guy who pulled it all together. Yeah, Morris's number two man, the right-hand man, you know, who, you know, for someone like that, you know, your big ideas, man. And there was also, you know, there was a lot of other stuff going on as well at the time. You've got to remember that they were developing the P2 into the P3 car, which was, you know, basically putting the post-war engine in, which they had to make that car a little bit wider. But they were also developing the P4 Rover car, the famous, the iconic, you know, auntie-style Rover, as well at the same time. So, yeah, for a small company, the engineering was absolutely flat out, you know, already. And suddenly having, you know, this, you know, other product come in, yeah, they had to do it really, really quickly. So Arthur had been running the test labs. He'd come from the aircraft industry, been testing engines at altitude, doing altitude testing for them. And he came into Rover to initially replace Jack Swain because Jack had had a motorcycle accident and broken both his legs, and was given the job of getting that, you know, 1.6-litre engine and its sister engine, the 2.16-cylinder, into production for, you know, the cars initially and ultimately the 1.6, the four-cylinder version for the Land Rover. And then he, you know, looked after the lab, you know, the research lab. And because he wasn't a specialist engineer like Jack or Gordon or anything, once they needed a project leader, a program leader, you know, he was given the job because Robert Boyle, who was the other, you know, who was the chief engineer, he was too busy with his cars and everything else going on to have another project. So Arthur got the job.
So one of the things that I was fascinated with, and you'll know why as soon as I mention it, is the center steer prototype. You know, that's the where you get the name for the podcast, of course. And interesting to read in the book, among other fascinating things, is that the you know, that's the prototype didn't last long. It was kind of like a road, you know, almost like a speed bump, and didn't last long. Can you, you know, add a little bit to that color to that story?
Yeah, I can add an incredible amount now because you know, hopefully I'll be able to do an update of this book at some stage in the not too distant future and go further into what we've found out about the center steer. Its sister vehicle, called the, which is called the Land Rover Mocker, that's its official name. And, you know, the third vehicle down the line, which is Huey, now. So, and how those three vehicles interact with one another. So the center steer, it was really a sort of, you know, the concept vehicle of the day. It was. They needed that. They produced it for a couple of reasons. One main reason was to show the board of directors, the money men, what they were thinking, what they were doing. The central steering was Morris really looking at these elements that he enjoyed looking at within engineering as exploratory dive into how was this vehicle going to work. And it's really easy to forget what he'd done in the 1930s because one of the elements he came up with for vehicle design in the 1930s was a freewheel unit, which basically works like a bicycle freewheel. And that was an element that he'd put into the Rover cars to try and, you know, add in a little bit of fuel economy to try and, you know, stop people having to change gears. It was almost sort of, you know, a stage before automatic gearboxes came in. And, you know, the good engineers were really, really interested in this kind of thing in the late 1930s, because 1936 had been an absolutely horrendous year for automotive accidents. And so they started to try and, you know, look at streamlining process within vehicles, which is why, of course, the accelerator, the brake and the clutch across any vehicles are always the same, because the industry had an agreement that's the way it was going to work. And, you know, Morrison putting that central steering in was him trying to sort of look at how can we make this vehicle better than a Willys? You know, Willys is really, really good. We know that. Mm-hmm. What can we make that's different? How can we go about it? And his nature, if you look at some of the old videos of him playing around with, you know, vehicles and Bren gun carriers and tractors and all kinds of things that he plays with, you'll come across a video. You'll actually see this if you go into the celebration, you know, the virtual celebration line. There's a video of him. There's a video of a lawnmower on a differential mowing his lawn automatically like a robot. And this is the kind of guy he was. He came up with these incredible ideas. But if you look at them in that sort of post-war time, they look slightly, you know, from today's point of view, slightly crazy. But if you actually break them down to what the elements are within the idea, they're brilliant. And, yeah, that's what that center steering vehicle is trying to achieve. So the second vehicle that came after that, you know, once the engineers were, you know, shown, you know, produce one of these, is the mock-up. And the mock-up's quite interesting. Now, we've got a lot of drawings of the mock-up. It didn't last terribly long. But they realized that, you know, it was going to be fairly impractical to get it to work, you know, since, you know, having an actual steering box behind the engine, because of course the center steer vehicle had a chain driving to the Jeep steering box from the center, so they could make it, they sort of cobbled it together and made it work. Whereas, you know, once they actually put it on paper, they realized that, you know, the driver was going to be way too far back in the vehicle for him to have any load space. But they came up with an idea which actually, you know, led to this one-step four-wheel drive system. And, you know, once again, it's very Maurice Wilks how these sort of ideas evolve and sort of play out. And the idea is initially, once again, was to try and make a four-wheel drive system which was going to be better than the Jeep system. And they initially went with a three-step system. And the steps were two-wheel drive, four-wheel drive, the freewheel unit, and high and low range. And what the freewheel unit was going to do was going to allow four-wheel drive on a hard surface. So it behaved like a differential in there. So you could, you know, have an extra option. It's obviously what you can't, unless you want the tyres to and the axles to wind up and scrub. It doesn't really work, four-wheel drive on a hard surface, terribly well. So they put that in, and from that center steer vehicle, the mock-up was actually going to have all its levers based up on the dash panel. And so they had these three levers, high and low range, freewheel lock and two-wheel drive, four-wheel drive. But you still had, obviously, the driver straddling, you know, the gearbox and the gear lever in the middle, a bit like a tractor. And, you know, it was awkward, very, very awkward. And they realised that, you know, it wasn't really going to work as a central steering vehicle. They needed to go right and left-hand drive, not just from a, you know, the packaging of the, you know, the driver, but also from a safety point of view. You can't if you're going down the road, you can't easily overtake in a centrally based vehicle, because you can't see around the next car.
Right.
And there's all kinds of things that you look at it and you say, actually, this is slightly impractical. So they went with conventional right and left-hand drive, and they had that drawn up by late November 1947. So, yeah, the original center steer was built in September 47. They got a photo of it as a unpainted vehicle, late September. The mock-up vehicle, we've got all the drawings from around about sort of second or third week of October 1947. at this point, the center steer is off being photographed. We've got the photographic ledger showing it's being photographed, doing this and doing that and doing the next thing, which if you look at the photographs, they're all stills. They're all the marketing shots that went into the sales brochures. And then by December, you've got all the drawings of what ultimately became Huey in place. So it all happened, once again, it all happened really, really quickly. And they realised that, that's not going to work, Yeah, which is, you know, obviously if you're doing real engineering, it's exactly what you do.
Very cool. That was the, I think, one of the more interesting things that I read in the book was certainly about the center steer and how it seemed like it was bigger in my mind, maybe because I focused on that name, but it was not really, because it almost seemed like, really quickly was dismissed as not a good idea.
So the idea, which was the really good idea, which came from the central steering, was this, initial good idea, was trying to, keep the driver's area free of clutter, which is, putting these levers up on the dashboard.
Yeah, it took General Motors until the mid-80s to have push-button four-wheel drive.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
Yeah,
it's
good idea. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Chrysler was doing push-button shifters in the 60s.
That's true. Well, and you had column shifting and three in the tree.
So what happened was, so that system got put onto the early pre-production vehicles, Huey and its sister vehicles. They're the three-step system. And it actually got signed off for production. It did. I've got the drawings of it. I've dug all those up. And you got to this really interesting stage because those early vehicles, they just, of course, just had a black knob on them. But obviously once they realised that they're going to have to sell this thing and they're going to have to describe to somebody, the customer, how to operate it, that they realised it was actually a little bit too complex in those days. Well, the idea is effectively what is terrain response today. If you're going to buy yourself a new Land Rover or a Range Rover product, because you've got these, fantastic system that you'll give you grass, gravel, snow and mud and ruts and all of that. Whereas that original system was trying to achieve effectively, a four-wheel drive for all surfaces, for all situations, hard surface, soft surface. But explaining it to somebody and getting them to actually operate it manually was going to be something else with three levers. So they decided to go with coloured knobs. And they had four coloured knobs because they had one for the power takeoff. And they had red, yellow, blue and green was the power takeoff. And so you start to try and explain to people, say, you've got high and low range, and you can have that as two-wheel drive, you can have it as four-wheel drive, and you can have it as three-wheel. And so you've got a variety of options.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd either have to have a nice little flow chart showing it on the dashboard, which would be massive, showing it how it worked. And, of course, people can make mistakes.
So was it a situation where you would do a combination of knobs, or was it one at a time?
You had to do a combination. So to get it into four-wheel drive, hard surface in low ratio, you would have had to pull the yellow lever because yellow is high and low ratio. Red was the freewheel. You'd have to unlock the freewheel, and then you'd have to put it into low ratio. So you had three steps you had to do.
Which is quite complex. Yep, absolutely.
Some of us are still confused by the red and yellow knobs in the current system.
As he looks at me. Yeah.
Well, anyway, so
mash the yellow pedal. That's all I know. Mash the yellow knob.
Yes. The yellow, in doubt, just hit the yellow one. So what happened was they realized it was going to be too complex, especially if you got people who just didn't, they weren't mechanically minded and they weren't going to, get their head around this. You've got your salesman and the salesman's not an expert in it, and he's sort of trying to, sell it. It wasn't going to be a great way of doing things. So they needed to very, very quickly simplify the system.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they decided to do is get rid of the levers on the dash, get rid of all three of them. Have one lever coming through the floor. Leave it as constant four-wheel drive initially with the freewheel unit. Get rid of the two-wheel drive, four-wheel drive option. And obviously in reverse, you need to be able to lock the freewheel unit because, once again, it works just like a bicycle. When you're accelerating, you've got to get any drive to the front axle. If you're going in reverse, you aren't getting any drive to the front axle. So they put a little ring in the floor to lock the freewheel unit in reverse, in low. And that worked. That was enough to be able to say, to the salespeople to have the vehicle and say, look, this is really easy, sir or madam. You know, just jump in, pull on that red lever, away you go. Mm-hmm. Job done. And that simplicity was what they, you know, what they nailed. They absolutely nailed it, you know. And, yes, it evolved. Obviously, the yellow reappeared as the, you know, initially as the freewheel lock, but then the high range four-wheel drive. How does the vehicle operate? You just push that yellow lever. Or if it's, you know, you need low range, just pull that red lever. Job done. Simple.
It's amazing how that continues to this day, too, because they, as you said, they moved into an electronic version of that with the, you know, set and forget, that terrain, you know, your terrain response is the same thing. And now all the other manufacturers are moving to the same thing. You know, Jeep has it and General Motors has it. And It goes back to that.
Auto terrain response in a Range Rover is exactly the same. Mm. Yeah, in a Range Rover, a Range Rover Sport, you just push low range, bang, job done.
Yeah.
Hill descent control comes in, it's all sorted for you. It's a good, simple little idea. But to get that idea initially, they had to go through all that, you know, center steer and was it going to be like this and going to be like that, which, you know, some people look at it and go, isn't it eccentric? Isn't it British? Isn't it quirky? It's actually just, you know, really good, simple engineering ideas, getting the ideas out and playing with them and seeing what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah, you got to try stuff and see if it's going to work or not.
Yeah, exactly.
So the other part of your book that I found interesting and fascinating was this conversation that an afternoon chat with Spen and Arthur, and we're not going to read it here, but it goes on and on, and this is shortly before Spen King passed away. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that experience was like? You pretty much were a fly on the wall, but it sounds very kind of just fascinating just to hear these two gentlemen talk for. Geez, that's tough to tell here. Maybe an hour or so, maybe longer.
It was an incredible moment. I wish I'd taken a photograph of him. The only reason I didn't take a photograph is because Spen had just had an operation on one of his eyes, and he was looking fine. But, you know, if your eye's a little bit, you know, been operated on, it's a little bit watery and puffy and, you know, just looks, you know, right. Just not entirely comfortable. That was the only reason I didn't, because he was sort of ever so slightly apprehensive, you know, initially when I spoke to him about having, he wanted to see Arthur, of course, he was totally up for that. But he was like, oh, you know, I'm not my best. I've just come back. I've just had this eye operation. And ultimately he wasn't allowed to drive, which is why he was riding his bicycle. And he was riding his bicycle around the village. And unfortunately he went in front of had an accident with a road vehicle, which, you know, extremely, extremely sad story.
Right.
But on the positive side, obviously, we got him. I sat down with him and Arthur for an hour or so, talking. And the other incredibly positive thing is that came out of that is that his son and his daughter, they, you know, because their dad was in quite good health. They hadn't bothered. Record him talking about his days at work or anything like that, just talking to a friend. And, you know, I'd just done this, you know, because it was, you know, I just, you know, put a recorder down and got it. So I gave him a copy of that. It's the only person I've given a copy of that that recording to, and they were delighted by that, to be able to sort of, you know, hear him just chatting away to one of his old mates about his, you know, good old days at the factory.
It's a wonderful memory for them, I'm sure.
Yeah. So, but it was an incredible moment. It was absolutely astounding. It was to have the two of them together and how they sort of said, I suppose, started. They hadn't seen each other for a long time. It would have been, Roger and I eventually got it down to it. It was late 1960s because originally they were going to use Girling brakes on what became, you know, the Range Rover, you know, what everyone calls now classic Range Rover, original Range Rover. But ultimately it ended up with Lockheed brakes. It did. Mm-hmm. But Arthur saw Spen about that. And I can't remember exactly the detail at the moment as to why they didn't go with the girling, but that was it. But after that, of course, Arthur moved out to Australia. So they hadn't seen each other for years and years and years. But we got them talking because they had a really great time. We got to, talking about all kinds of elements. And, one of them was the wheel wobble on the original vehicles with the springs shackled at the front with the skinny springs. Spen remembered that quite well and remembers the issue. So obviously they spoke a lot about the Rover jet car days because they'd both been working on that. Arthur designed the starting system for Jet 1 and had been out there in Belgium where Spen had done the time trial on the Gebek Highway in Belgium. And, they spoke about all kinds of different elements, of the company today, what had happened, a little bit about the sort of Range Rover sort of side of things, how that sort of, developed, I suppose, from Spen's point of view, from the, late 1950s Road Rover days right up to Range Rover, what became Range Rover. It was an incredible moment. I sort of sat there with a cup of tea and a biscuit, sort of, dumbstruck by this, having these two talking away. And when Spen, unfortunately, passed away, I think it was only about a month later or so.
Right.
Yeah, we couldn't believe it.
Did you find that they were surprised at all by Land Rover's success? Or was this something that they said, oh, yeah, of course, it kind of naturally happened? I'm curious what your sense of that was.
No, they have absolute confidence in the company and the Wilkeses. And, of course, Spen is part of the Wilkes family because he's Spen King's mother's, Morris Wilkes and Spencer Wilkes' sister.
Oh. I can't remember. Well, of course, your knowledge is clearly your Land Rover knowledge is bar none. But that one's not had not heard before.
Morris Wilkes and Spencer Wilkes were Spence King's uncles.
All in the family then.
In the family. Yeah.
Well, Mike, I appreciate you spending the past hour or so talking to us about the book and Land Rover history. And if it's okay with you, we're going to have you on next month for part two to talk about what happened with you and how you turned this into a career. Is that acceptable?
Yeah, absolutely.
So anybody have any last-minute questions for Mike about the book or about the history of Land Rover?
Well, I'm still trying to soak in everything he said. I'm sort of dumbstruck over here.
I know. your knowledge, man, just of dates and months and what exactly happened when is amazing. And you are working on a second book or an update to the book. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm working on it. I've been working on one for quite a while, but obviously we needed – the story to come to its conclusion when the vehicle, defended to stop. I need to get Arthur's opinion on that. I haven't quite got Arthur's opinion on that. He was out from Australia in the UK in September. We, obviously did quite a bit with him. We got him to have a look at the 2 millionth Defender and we did a few other things, which, you'll find out about soon. And
was Mr. Goddard at the final production day? Was he there? That wasn't clear to me.
No, he wasn't. He was back in Australia.
Okay.
He was. Unfortunately, he couldn't. It was one of those things. It was we all really wanted to get him over to do as much as he wanted to, or much as he could. But you've got to remember he's he's 94 years old. And he lives 10,000 miles away.
And we should all be so lucky as to be as well as he is, from what I can tell at his age. Yeah. Well, Mike, thanks very much for joining us on the show today. We will have you back next month to continue our conversation. How do people track you down? I know that you have a couple websites. A couple of accounts on Facebook. What's the best way to track your book down and to connect with you?
Yeah, the book just find it on Amazon. Just search "They Found Our Engineer" on Amazon, and you'll find it.
I'll have a link in the show notes for that.
Yeah, and myself is the best thing to do is to find me is either on Facebook or on Twitter as 260AC. The reason why I'm calling myself 260AC is because I'm part owner of pre-production Land Rover number 16, and it's another incredible story. That's how I got to know Roger. But it ran around in the factory on a trade plate, which was 260AC. So
we're teasing that for next month.
Yeah. There's another incredible story.
Absolutely. Well, that'll be that's good entry for – that'd be a good teaser for next month. We'll talk about 260AC. But, yeah, you're – I know on Twitter you're at 260AC. You and I have communicated back and forth. You can also search for that in on Facebook, 260AC. There's a page dedicated to that, and you can link with him on that. And I think actually there's a Facebook page for the book also. I don't have links to all that in the show notes. So thanks again, Michael, and we'll talk to you next month about your next how you turned this into a career. Effectively, you now work for Land Rover Jaguar itself.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it.
Wonderful. Thanks very much. And that brings a close to show number 35 of the Center Steer podcast. I want to thank our guest, Mike Bishop, for joining us today. That was part one of our conversation with Mike. In March, we're going to talk about how he parlayed his enthusiasm for Land Rovers into a job with Land Rover. And that'll be part two. So that's the show for this month. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I want to thank you for listening. Please visit our website for past shows, show notes, and especially all the things we talked about today and more. Also, connect with us on Facebook and Twitter to give us your feedback on news and topics we discussed this month and even the audio quality. We continue to make sure that the audio quality is there, or at least I'm working on it to make sure the audio quality is there, and it's I know that's the most important thing about an audio podcast is good audio quality. We have listeners from around the world. We'd love to hear from you, even if it's just a picture of your Land Rover or a Land Rover that you lust after. Post that for us on Facebook or tweet it as. Also, visit the 4x4 radio network to listen to other shows that are part of the network. You can listen to those shows right on the website and also our show. Until next month, I ask you to share the show with one fellow Land Rover owner. Thanks for listening, and please wave as you pass by. Don't go away.
I won't.